Ladies and gentlemen, if y'all would like to get settled in, we'll get started. My name's Ed, and I am an addict. Hey, family. Let's open this workshop with a moment of silence, followed with a string of prayer, please. Surrender prayer. God, grant us the serenity to accept the things we cannot change, courage to change the things we can, and the wisdom to know this. All right. Good morning and welcome to the History Workshop. This morning will be a workshop basically on the history of the basic text. And we'll have a panel workshop, and hopefully toward the end of it we'll get a chance to open up for questions from the floor, you know, just time permits and all that stuff. I've asked Marilyn to come up and read Hood's Magic for us.
My name's Marilyn. I'm an addict. Hi, family. Who is an addict? Most of us do not have to think twice about this question. We know. Our whole life and thinking was centered in drugs in one form or another, the getting and using and finding ways and means to get more. We live to use and use to live. Very simply, an addict is a man or woman whose life is controlled by drugs. We are people in the grip of a continuing and progressive illness whose ends are always the same: jails, institutions, and death.
Thank you, Marilyn. I've asked Virginia to come up and read her 12 traditions.
I'm an addict. My name is Virginia. We keep what we have only with vigilance, and just as freedom from the individual comes from the 12 steps, so freedom for the group springs from our traditions. As long as the ties that bind us together are stronger than those that would tear us apart, all will be well. One, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends on NA unity. Two, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. Three, the only requirement for membership is the desire to stop using. Four, each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or NA as a whole. Five, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry the message to the addict who still suffers. Six, an NA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the NA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, or prestige divert us from our primary purpose. Seven, every NA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. Eight, Narcotics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. Nine, NA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10. Narcotics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues. Hence, the NA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11. Our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and film. And 12. Anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
Okay, before we get started, naturally there's a couple of to-dos to do. Public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity level of press, radio, and films. If any members of the press are present, please contact someone in the registration area for information. We ask no pictures be taken during the meeting. And also, please, be considerate going in and out of the room. If you do want to congregate, please do so outside so you won't disturb the thing. There are people trying to listen, and please be attentive to that. Banquet tickets, please, if you want to go, please buy them before 12 o'clock. Basically, what we're trying to do, or what we're going to do today, is try to give y'all a little bit more in-detailed history of the basic text other than what you hear by general word of mouth. And one of the things that helped me tremendously in my early years of recovery, you know, was to be involved in the getting involved was basically done on a dare. You know how we are. Sometimes we have to be motivated into doing different things. This one guy that I knew had went to the first World Literature Conference in Wichita and come back and told me about all the people that was there, you know, and da-da-da-da-da, and all the stuff that they done. I did not completely believe what he was saying. Skeptical would be more like it, and he just politely told me that, well, at the next one I could go, and curiosity got the best of me, so I went to Lincoln, Nebraska to see who else would actually show up, and who else actually would, not too good with hand language sometimes, because I wanted to know. You know, as I shared last night, I'd got a little bit intimidation from other people that, you know, throwing things up in my face and all that stuff. And now the microphone is not going to do right. No, that's the air conditioner, isn't it? Yeah. Will. These things do have a mind of their own. So, you know, and that's what I like is, you know, it's serious stuff, but a little fun and games or a little funny every now and then is real good. But there was just so much, you know, to be said, and it's still difficult even after all this time to put into words what I felt when I was sitting in that room with 60 other people. And, you know, us sitting there trying to brainstorm and took the little white book and, well, what are we going to do next, you know? I mean, there had been some preliminary work done in Wichita, and here we was in Lincoln, Nebraska, of all places. You know, when I was being raised up, Lincoln, Nebraska was, you know, like the other side of the world. And here I was with people from different states, and their concern about a basic text for Narcotics Anonymous was the same as mine. And I was allowed to feel that more part of. You know, and a little bit of what I was talking about last night in the way of the movement and missing the hippie era and all that, and clean, I was getting a chance to actually live out that. You know, and one of the things about my using, one of the excuses I used a lot of times was, well, if I'd only been in the pioneer days, you know, I could have been a real man and killed a bear and all that stuff. And the movement with the book, it was the pioneer days. And we did get to do a lot of things for the first time. You know, I'm not saying that there's not a lot of first to be done here. You know, one of the goals in H&I in our area that a lot of people don't know about is have a meeting in every institution, including the jails. You know, and, I mean, it's hard to get somebody, well, it's new territory, it's not popular to go to jail. It's clean. We all love to have that partner. Well, I've been in jail 16 times. But you get them clean, they wouldn't go to jail for nothing, you know. So a lot of that pioneer spirit is still there. It may be clouded up a little bit by, you know, the 90s, but it's still there. And it was shown to me, and, you know, because I thought it was clouded up in the late 70s and 80s, you know. Well, the hippie era is gone. And it wasn't, you know, because we still got to do a lot of good things. And I'm not going to take up all the time. And we haven't drawn straws to see who was going to be next. You know, so Greg's going to be next. Okay. So I'll give the mic to Greg. Thank you.
My name's Greg. I'm an addict.
Hi, Greg.
And I guess this first go-round, and I don't know that we even really know what we're doing. There's nothing new about that. That's been going on for years. We're going to kind of tell a little bit about how we actually got involved in this whole process. And I was sitting down there trying to think how I got involved in this whole process. Probably, I got involved like so many other people get involved in these processes by somebody figuring out, oh, here's a live one, what can we get in to do? I really think that's kind of the way it was. Somehow I ended up on some kind of literature committee in 1971. A variety of things had happened. We used to have a meeting, a tape meeting, in fact. The purpose of the meeting was to develop material for literature. And every Saturday we'd meet down at this guy's house and run the tape recorders and have a meeting. I don't know what ever became of any of that stuff. To my knowledge, none of it ever became any literature. But it was real interesting, and there was the interest there. And I guess that's how I really got involved. I've got a letter I wrote in 72 asking for input for a text. Part of the problem, I think, for me was that there was always so much to do and so few bodies to do it. In the 70s, you didn't stay involved in any one thing very long because you were so busy fighting fires. There was no service structure. There was no working service boards and committees. There was one. There wasn't anybody taking care of your service needs. If there was a need, you went and did it. If there wasn't a group somewhere in some part of town, you went over in that part of town and found a building and started a group. And then you went there every week for a year. If there was a need for H&I work, you didn't wait for some committee to tell you the correct way to do it. You went and did it, and you tried to follow the traditions to the best of your ability. If there was a PI need, if, for instance, this was in California, if the LA County Sheriff's Department wanted an orientation on NA, you didn't go to a PI committee because there weren't any. You know, a member who'd been around some time grabbed a couple of little white booklets and went and did it. And that's really the way it was, and there weren't too many bodies going around. I think, you know, there were maybe half a dozen live wires. And I guess I got involved in the basic text before there was really much of an effort going. I've heard Bo talk about our first meeting and some of that stuff, and I know that during the 70s, we were always on the lookout for another live wire. And if anybody showed any interest, they got encouraged. They got put on a committee. They got asked to participate, but very little was forthcoming. There was some writing prior and some work done towards new literature prior to the effort for the basic text, and maybe we'll talk about that in another section. But that's how I got. I felt like I was here before we started a little bit on that. got involved the same way the rest of us get involved.
Hi, I'm Jim. I'm an addict.
Hi, Jim.
And probably to be chronological, we ought to take him next. But since I'm standing up here, I'll talk. I got a letter in the mail. I think that was the first thing. Maybe it wasn't, but it sounds dramatic, so I'll share it that way. I got a letter in the mail. It said, "You are the book. You are the book." And went on to talk about how maybe you're the only basic text anybody will ever read, your story, and you sharing it, unless you write it down, we're not going to have one. I think that's what got me started writing it down. And that's probably the most important part of my being a part of the service effort, was actually sitting down with that most intimidating of things, a blank sheet of paper and a pencil. When I was about 3 months clean, but claimed I had a year and 3 months, I went to my first convention. Which was a world convention, because that was the only kind of conventions that there were at the time. It was in Atlanta, and I about left about 10 times because there wasn't a single NA speaker. Not that the people didn't do, you know, what they thought was right and shared some sort of kind of like recovery with everybody, and had a lot of spirit and a lot of caring, a lot of love, care, and concern. They just weren't NA speakers. They didn't find their recovery here and didn't perceive themselves as being powerless over addiction. So that told me, you know, I'm very judgmental. The more you hear me talk, the more you'll understand that. And I make a decision right up about a speaker, and did even more so then. But at any rate, we couldn't get literature in our group at home, and I wanted to go see why and fix it. And figured I could, just by jumping up and down and screaming. Heard about Wichita, heard about there being a thing for the book, a movement to write the book, but probably the most important thing was that I went to a clubhouse outside of Atlanta after the convention and heard an NA speaker, and sat in on this service committee meeting, and sat up next to a cuddly, pudgy fella in overalls who put his arm around me and took me off to the side afterwards and said, you need a tree. And this guy went and hunted in his house for about 3.5 hours. Probably was right on top of the desk, you know what I mean? But he hunted in his house and brought it out after a long time. And I got involved and I got cared for. I think that's what I'm trying to say here with a lot of words, is that I got loved and cared for. I got an arm put around me with a lot of love, care, and concern, and the feeling of, we want you involved. We will include you whenever you're here. We'll spend whatever time it takes to explain these concepts to you. And what you have to say, what you have to share is important. And it doesn't matter who you are, where you've been. And that's the feeling that I got, the spirit that I caught, and the service that I found in the Lit Committee and in World Service in 1979-1980. And that's what kept me coming and got me involved. And that's what more than even recovery, that service experience, that inclusiveness, that teaching about surrender, is what's made me able to be who I am today.
here I am out of order again. My name's Bogus, and I'm an addict.
Hello.
Hey, everybody. Well, I feel like I got started on this last night, because, you know, I don't want to show be as dumb as I am and repeat everything, but, you know, really, in a way, maybe that's what I need to do, maybe from a slightly different angle. For one thing, I'm real glad that, you know, Ed and Jim and Greg and I can be here, and I still hope our other buddy Joel drag in from Memphis. But, you know, we may try to keep it light, but actually we're sort of like revolutionaries, and the wars are real, and the wounds are real, and we have casualties, so Joe can't make it, pray for him. But, you know, our battles and all that are played out in these halls, and we do the best we can to care and share, and occasionally get a chance to really do something in service. I guess, you know, my personal starting place is, it seems like everything else in my life, I was either there, you know, wherever it was and whatever the main event was, I was there very much after it happened, or I was there very much before it happened. But whatever it was, I was never around when it was happening. I was always reading about it, hearing about it, doing some dope, but somehow I kept missing it, whatever it was. I wasn't even sure that it was real or it ever really happened, except obviously there's a lot of stuff around, so you figure it came from someplace, but, you know, like how exactly be there and be in on it. You know, I was always too young or too old or too fat or too skinny or too smart or too dumb or too early or too late, or just out of sync, actually. And, of course, part of the time, and actually, Dixon, I may have not actually been out of sync, except I put myself out of sync with what I put in. So missed chances that way. So, you know, the last thing I expected when I read the lines in a book called The Beats that Sin and I drew out of some meetings in a building where NA meetings of Narcotics Anonymous were held in Santa Monica, that I would ever get involved much with NA, because I was just a 16-year-old beatnik reading a book and, you know, find out how to be weird. And then, you know, truncating the whole deal a little bit, maybe I can do the math. I think it was around 71 or so, I called information in Atlanta and asked if there was a meeting of Narcotics Anonymous in Atlanta, because all of my background and behavior up to that point, it seemed like I should be contacting Narcotics Anonymous. And at that point, I just spent 2 years on the strip down in Atlanta. I was on the 6 o'clock, 11 o'clock news whenever I wanted to be. The mayor came to Human Improvement Project in Kent Street in Atlanta frequently. We used to figure out ways to force him to come down. And if he didn't come down, we'd go down there. Like one time, Muhammad Ali donated $50,000 to fight addiction in Atlanta. And this rough-looking hippie with me, blonde hair like this, leans over this desk and says, "How about some of that $50,000 by myself?" And Sam leaned back, you know. And, you know, people were dying down there, and we interacted with federal, state, local efforts, churches, do-gooders, societies, medical societies. There were Jesuits down there. There were federal people down there. There were a lot of people goodwill down there. A lot of people come down there looking for their kids. A lot of times we develop relationships with families / kids. You know, a lot of weird stuff happened. I got at the end, I had to strap on a loaded six gun every time the sun went down, because it was just that rough down there, just to feel okay, like I could walk to the store and back. The reason I'm stressing all this is because a two-year experience like that, working at night and day, eating, sleeping, breathing it, reading magazines, hearing what other people brought to my ears, and they brought a lot, all convinced me that there was absolutely no hope anywhere on the entire planet for addict seeking recovery. There was no hope at all. There was no hope. There was none. There was nothing you could do. You were trapped. It was over. There was no way out. There was no such thing as living clean. It was like you slid into a pit I guess you got them around here, these little damn bugs, these creatures that live in the sand and make a living off of killing ants. And the way they do it is they make a little suck hole for themselves, and the ant comes in. And if it ever crosses within that circle where it's like a fallen cone, then ant lines, I think is one name for them. Well, they kick up sand so the little creature, even though it struggles and maybe thinks it's going to get to the edge and get out, it really does. It's, you know, it just kind of keeps falling to the lower circle till that bottom of the ant land can, like, bite it, suck its juice out and all that. Kind of like ground spatters in a way. But being an addict was sort of like that. I mean, once you were over the edge a little too far, you might see the edge again. You might think you was going to actually get out, but something would always happen right before you did, and you'd, like, be at a lower level. And it was real. I'm sure everybody in this room knows how ridiculously I'm glossing over the actual horror and feeling that goes with discovering you're that kind of addict. And something's got you, and you can't see the motherfucker, but you know it's there because it's doing it to you. And sometimes we're struggling to be nice. Sometimes we're struggling to do better. Sometimes we're struggling to be a good person, do the right thing. But as soon as we get close to the edge and like we're going to be on the way with our lives, something has got us, and something kicks in our face, and something, we fall down. And all we know is we're trapped and can't get out of it until the last moment. And then we know something's got us, but we don't have time to talk about it much. Well, clean addicts are sort of like people that figured out something had them, and if they're going to do any talking, they better talk quick. And mostly, I think, because a lot of us have seen our friends die, you know, using car accident, choking on puke, OD, shot, stabbed. You know, there's just a lot of ways. This one young lady shared with me, and God, I hope she's here. I hope she can hear this. I hope she don't get pissed at me talking about it. But it's just so fucking typical. And this woman was shooting dope with her girlfriend, and the girlfriend had the dope, and she naturally wanted the dope. So they both got off, and then her girlfriend went into a heavy knob, so she took the rest of the dope and shot it, and then split before her girlfriend could come out of the nod, because she didn't want to get yelled at for stealing the rest of the dope and doing it. And left the woman there, passed down on the couch with her 2 or 3 year old daughter, and found out later that her girlfriend had died and the little baby had been left with her dead mom on the couch for 3 days and didn't feel too hot about herself, you know. Thought, well, maybe, you know, there was something wrong with the way she was living. It didn't have anything to do with the cops, the establishment, or all the TV ideas about what drug addiction is. So, coming from that background, and the thing we've been doing on the strip sort of died out, which is great. I tried calling Narcotics Anonymous. We held like 6 meetings and had a green covered copy of the white booklet, and I had no idea about anonymous principles or real steps or traditions, and the people who were good enough to provide the green covered booklet for alcoholics, and I couldn't relate to that. And I thanked him a lot. And, you know, we just, after a while, we stopped meeting him, and he was just, you know, it was like trying to learn a song and can't quite catch the tune. And so 3 years later is my clean date. And I've been going to meeting ever since, June 10th, 1974. And, yeah, I think I went through a stage, you know, there was, let's see, if I got clean in 74 and there wasn't even the grape form until 80 or so, that means I was somewhat focused around the little white booklet for maybe 6 years. And I understand how somebody, a lot of people feel real strong, but I feel strongly about some of the lines in Recovery and Relapse, some of the lines in We Do Recover, some of the basic stuff in the, about the steps. I think I've read a few of the stories in the back a couple of times. The thing that kept me going was the sincere newcomers, the idea of recovery, all the discussions, all the phone calls, eventually all the meetings. When NA finally started clicking and growing, there were meetings in nearby states and other parts of the country and communicating with them. Those are the things that really fired my recovery. And in a sense, more because being in the situation that God set up for me, we had such, like, terrifically sincere newcomers. The questions they asked kept me moving and jumping and calling and writing, trying to get their answers. And you couldn't do something as simple as go to a book and flip it open to section you read. And this is even with the other material from Alcoholics Anonymous or from other sources that, you know, we were doing the best we could back then. And the answers just really weren't there. And there were breakdowns. I mean, I was going into NA meetings and there would be NA newcomers there. Sometimes quite upset, sometimes real pissed off about the notion of having to substitute drugs and alcohol and problems other than drugs, which is a famous piece. And I said, hey, look, I know something about that program, and that guy did not mean to ever piss somebody like you off or make you uncomfortable or kill your chances of recovery. So I believe if that guy were here today, he would tell you to do what I'm going to tell you to do, and that's tear that damn pamphlet in half and throw it in the trash. And it's like the guy was trapped a moment before I said that, but the idea that he could do that, and plus he had my support, encouragement, and permission, he was suddenly free. And that guy's still clean today, right? But, you know, a lot of people didn't have somebody there to say, no, get clean. That's the main thing. Don't pay attention to that paper. It'll upset you. And it was just like that kind of sort of like fertile land or something. You know, just there's so much shit there. You know, any seed that drops in is bound to grow. And but I had pressure put on me like that, and I hit the NA trail. Oh, it's sickening how I read occasionally how phrases like this get turned around. I headed out for the greater NA. I had to discover the greater NA. I heard that line like abused by someone who quoted as an instance of like better NA than NA was where they were at, or something weird like that. Okay? I mean, I don't know what that is. Sometimes I think it's everybody's like born into recovery somewhere and they've got themselves and their locale and their circle of friends, and somehow the old human habit of anybody that's close, anybody I know their name, anybody in my circle of friends, it's okay. But those other people, you know, they're out to get you. I mean, even within the fellowship, it's sort of like we're all ape men or something, and we got to live by the law of the fang. And if you're not careful, then somehow come in and burn your village. It's real weird. think something that changed my recovery experience early on was, and from being a hippie all them years and all the other stuff, was just the idea that if the most dangerous thing to do, short of actually using, was to wish harm to another member. And it's been extremely difficult to walk the mile of walks and not wish harm to other members, because there have been some real thieves and assholes and some bitches along the way. But I've never wished them harm. I've always tried to, like, rationalize it and play down the bad part of it and accentuate the good part of it. And I was used to overriding. I mean, you know, you don't have a choice of drugs like LSD without stressing the positive and emphasizing a lot of interaction and being objective. And I still bear marks from that. You know, maybe they'll continue to rub out of my personality. But the main thing is when people like us got clean, there was no basic text. Like Greg says, I saw a copy of a letter sent out from the office in 1972. Maybe that was it, or it was another one. There was a mock letter saying that an effort for writing the basic text was underway. You know, like, don't miss out, send your story in today. And nobody went for it. Nobody sent in their story or nothing. And when I had been in contact with Jimmy Cannon and several other people, maybe, but mainly Jimmy, and I wasn't satisfied with my answers. I mean, I had actually reached the point where, together with another member, I'd sit down and written a letter saying, like, if there's a group conscience, where is it? Where does it live? What is its name? Does it have a phone number? Does it have a mailing address? And I'm just short of being insulting, like, what in the hell's going on? Because I was getting dodges on the telephone. And I kept asking and re-asking the same kinds of questions over about 8 pages. And guess what? I got back a postcard. Nice postcard. It's okay, kid. Things are fine. You know, keep the faith, baby. Like, you know, I think sometimes people in World Services think they're dealing with little children. And with my background and all, you know, somehow just happened to be on this Delta flying west for the World Convention. You know? Coincidentally, of course, but, you know, they were, like, just knocked back that somebody was there from the East Coast, me and Tommy Burchard, and that we actually flew in for the World Convention. They kept expecting that we flew in to visit family or out there on business, or why are you here? For the convention. They would yell across the room, hey, there's somebody here for the convention all the way from Georgia. And the next thing was, there I am at the World Convention, at the Jack Tar in San Francisco, walking around, just enormous numbers of possibly clean addicts who still look pretty weird and a little bit street hard. But nevertheless, I mean, I had every reason to suppose they were clean, whatever stage of recovery they might be in. And there wasn't much on the program that year about the basic text of Narcotics Anonymous. And there wasn't much in the little display room about where the early meetings were held, about who was working on our book. And I literally went through about a dozen people saying things like, well, nice weather, it's really pretty out here, who's working on our book? And, you know, it's like I'd begin with a couple of lame lead sentences, and then I'd immediately get to that other sentence. And then it was simple navigation, you know, they'd say, like, go over there, and I'd go over there, and they'd say, go over there, and I'd go over there, and I kept zinging back, homing in on the registration desk. They could have just told me at the gate, but that's where I wound up. And within about 5 minutes, I met Jack Whaley and Jimmy Cannon and Greg Pierce and Von Barrett and Chuck Skinner and all these guys hanging around this desk. And that was, you know, in a way, like that was effectively World Services in a big way. I didn't meet any Magdalenos at that time. And there were other people around, but as far as the people that were active at that point, and I can still recall the names, they played a significant major role, like Jimmy really did do some early work. Jimmy really did pick up the fire and carry the banner after the early efforts of the NA on the east died out, and did manage to be there and sit there with that one shuddering newcomer and not give up. And off on maybe. Maybe he did it because he was a great man. Maybe it was an ego trip. It don't much matter, you know. He did it. And that does count for something here as elsewhere. And, you know, there had been early efforts for literature, the white booklet and so on, but it just seemed like they all took forever. And a lot of time passed before progress started happening. So anyway, I'm asking these people who's worked on our book, when I'm still getting zinged, but the space across which I'm getting zinged is getting shorter, and then I meet old Greg, and that was the weirdest thing, because now I'm meeting an NA old-timer who's young, a young NA old-timer, who's also the chairman of the Board of Trustees. And like on the outside, I'm going like, yep, yep, and on the inside, I'm going, oh, goody. And, you know, and I mean, I wasn't being very indirect. I mean, I was, you know, asking pretty straightforward questions for me, not very objective at all. I'm making jokes. I get criticized for being objective and indirect and all that. And really, I got knocked back for asses so hard that I guess I still am in difficult situations where I'm trying to be nice. And then I wind up getting criticized for being indirect and objective when really it's just my only way of handling very difficult situations. So I stopped laughing at them and wasting y'all's time and get back to the story. And I do love them, but it's hard. But so me and Greg's talking, and the funniest thing happens is I stopped zinging because he had to go do something, so I tagged along. Then I had to do something and was amazed to find him tagging along. Now, wait a minute, he's supposed to start, be real busy and say, yeah, check with me later and go see so-and-so. And suddenly I ain't zinging. Plus, we're talking about mutual interest. And so, I mean, I like a real, whatever it was, checking my luggage or something like that. And I had really had to do it. And then when I got done, then I went wherever he was going, and we wound up going around the building. And somehow, we weren't too good at catching on that day. But the inevitable happened. We went up to his room, and he pulled out some cases with some documents in it and started going through paperwork like we were doing to 5:30 last night. And, see, I mean, once an act, always an act, right? And, love that paperwork. And I liked it because I thought it was cool stuff, but I also thought about the members back home because, see, they had no way of going to San Francisco themselves, and this was a way to take home something and give pieces of it away and let them know it was really happening, because without the evidence in those days, I mean, a photocopy was a valuable instrument because it was a way to let the people back home get encouragement and hope, and it's really happening, and here, look at this, and here, look at that. And let them know the whole goddamn thing was real, because back then, you know, if you hear things about the Sister Fellowship thinking it's bigger than we are and better off and more meetings and all that, I mean, it was hell back then. And we need the evidence bad. And the DNA was for real, that our program worked, that the traditions meant something, that the 12 steps were valid principles of recovery, as practiced by NA members in NA meetings. And I mean, all that of that for NA stuff, a lot of it's become reality in the last 10 or 15 years. It didn't come easy. And took low blows, you know, within the fellowship and from external forces. And I guess what's happening, you know, is like it's easier to come out front and just talk about this because now you're all Narcotics Anonymous. Okay, the days in which we got clean, 10% of the room might be real NA members. So we had to watch our step. Think about that. I mean, it was fucked. And it was hard to do something about it. And there was no way to judge them. There was no way, even if I got to talk to you or you or you and spend time with you, I couldn't really tell. If you'd liked him, you probably wouldn't have to know. He might act and talk and express things to where you're not, and then 10 years later, here you still are. And then there were a lot of people that seemed like they were NA members, but they wouldn't do nothing for the fellowship they were supposed to love and care about so much. Let somebody else do it was their philosophy. And you know, it's real. One of the best tributes to the disease of addiction in the past 20 years is the way some members talk bad about service and service workers and service work and volunteer service workers, and how senseless it is and how